for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Discussing the politics of the new European populism, Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show. We are going to talk about the Russian elections. Russia won, Putin won with 87% of the vote, and yes, it was probably a stage managed. But you'll hear all that stuff in the mainstream media about Russia's dictatorship and all that. Maybe, you know, I don't want to hold a candle for them, and I don't speak Russian. I was there in the 1990s when it was really desperately poor, and from what I can judge, it's much, much better off. And that could explain at least some of Putin's support. I know that I was quoting a Gallup poll in Russia from a few days ago, and it's a Western company, obviously, and they said that Russians feel better off than they've ever done before and more optimistic about the future and less worried about violence than any time. And remember, it was a country where gangsters ran everything, and Putin seemed may have sorted that out. I'd also like to add that maybe at least some of Putin's support could come from the fact that, you know, Russia's under siege. I've read up and written a lot about Swedish history, and Sweden were under its social democratic hegemony from 1932 to 1976, 44 years of nonstop left-wing rule. It was a democratic country, there's no question about that, and very successful and rich, but one party through its control of the unions and managing to, I wouldn't say control the media, but they were, everyone was kind of social democrat, and you wouldn't get a job really in many places unless you joined that. And it was a hegemonic state capitalism type of party, but with a lot of private interest as well. But I mean, they were getting nearly 50% of the vote year after year, despite people complaining. And no one has ever said Sweden is a democracy, and they managed to rule 44 years nonstop. And at least some of Putin's support comes from the sort of conformism of the workplace and conformism of the towns and the local leaders all going with Putin. Plus the fact that, you know, when people feel under siege and there's a very, very sort of strong state media pushing this a narrative, just as the Swedish media pushed it in the 1940s and 50s, ironically against the Soviet Union, you can vote for this. But there's nothing we can do about that, because at best, are we going to impose Russian democracy on Russia by bombing them? Obviously not. You know, it's a problem for them to solve. And as said, we should look at our issues first. I mean, we've got uniparties in Britain, we've got censorship, and a media that is completely unreliable. So I say, don't look at what the media are doing about another country we can't do anything about. And even if we could, you know, I mean, it's going to lead to war and chaos for that country, just as we imposed war and chaos in Iraq, Syria, and Libya when we're trying to impose democracy on those countries. So it's just a hopeless case. I just want to talk about Putin and peace, because here's another Western lie. The Wall Street Journal's European correspondent Yaroslav Trofimov said that Putin wasn't interested in peace because he was just talking about, you can't negotiate. It'd be ridiculous for us to start negotiating with Ukraine just because it's running out of ammunition. This quote was picked up by Reuters and many other places, and is taken to be, you know, the naivety of us who want a negotiated peace. But Yaroslav Trofimov, the WSJ, the Wall Street Journal chief correspondent, didn't actually quote Putin's main statement, which he made to a Russian journalist in the same week. He said, are we ready to negotiate? Sure, we are, but we're definitely not ready for talks that are based on some kind of wishful thinking which comes after the use of psychotropic drugs. So he's saying, yes, we are very interested in talking about peace. And that wasn't included. And the psychotropic drugs remark was presumably a dig at Macron, who might be taking nefarious substances while he is talking about sending troops to Ukraine. Anyway, everyone says, well, we didn't quote that, maybe because, you know, Putin can't be trusted anyway, because, you know, he's an adversary or an enemy. But the point is, wars have ended in the past based on opponents who hate each other and don't trust each other. It's got to start somewhere. And it's got to start by quoting the other person and you edging towards each other, unless we're going to have an all-out war with this country. You know, I just don't see why we're insisting on misquoting him, taking him at his word, and then start edging. The Vietnamese opponents, North and Vietnam, absolutely detested each other in the 1960s, and there was a peace agreement made there. So I think that it shows, of course, to Russians when they read this, how many bad faith actors there are in the West. And of course, it makes them think that the negotiations can't take place. And of course, what Putin meant was that he's going to the four provinces that are Russian speaking or pro-Russian anyway in eastern Ukraine are going to join Russia. But to be honest, I don't care if Ukraine loses 20%, as long as the killing stops. These people are, what's Ukraine going to do if it got those provinces back? I mean, they're anti-Ukrainian. Ukraine can't deal with it. So, I mean, you know, call me selfish if you like, but Ukraine was never, these provinces were brought together in a state that didn't exist before 1991. Anyway, so that's just the latest lie coming out of the Western media, and I thought you'd know about that. Even though they might be telling the truth about a Russian irregular election. Anyway, we've got more about this from Basil, the political editor, Basil Valentine, after a quick break. This is TNT Radio.
There's a lot going on, so it's important to stay informed and up to date.
Get ready, because here we go.
At the top, 30 minutes past, and when it breaks.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine, the political editor, with us, who's got some info on the Russian election. What have you got for us, Basil?
First of all, Russia is going to be asked for a ceasefire by French President Emmanuel Macron. Yesterday, he asked for a ceasefire during the Olympic Games. They, the Russians, have to do it. That's what has always happened. This is a message of peace, he is quoted as having said. Very mixed messages from Macron. Obviously, a ceasefire would be extremely welcome. I wonder whether an Olympic ceasefire might lead to a longer ceasefire. Macron said that France will also respect the decision of the Olympic Committee to allow Russian athletes to compete under a neutral flag. The rule of the host country is to go along with the Olympic movement, he said. Of course, we will closely monitor their performance so that nobody takes advantage of the athletes in this situation. I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but this is the merest olive branch, isn't it? Old sports to the rescue. The Olympics and, you know, international competition between nation states, I've always thought was an extremely healthy and welcome thing. Much better to sort out your differences in the fencing arena or the gymnastics gymnasium or on the running track rather than with guns, bombs and tanks.
Yeah, I remember the 1980 Olympics, actually, held in Moscow. And I think the Americans boycotted it and the West Germans. And that's when Britain had its best medal haul because they decided not to boycott. Daley Thompson, I think. I remember him running around.
That's right.
The track there.
Anyway, and Alan Wells, the Scottish sprinter.
Right. And I remember the sort of sense of peace or whatever, because that was at the height of the last Cold War. And it was a message of hope in a way, you know.
Yes,
hope
exactly.
That works out. So we don't know really what Macron, I don't know if Macron knows what he's thinking or if he's, because he seems to be sending troops 1 second and then doing nothing or offering an olive branch the next second. And obviously, maybe he's laboring under the reputation. I mean, Trump has been quoted as saying, 120 pounds of fury. 120 pounds, that's less than 60 kilos. So, I mean, that's Trump bullying him to his, Trump telling his mates at the White House and saying Trump is he's a wussy and
Macron
all that.
Macron is a lightweight. Macron is a lightweight, basically, yes.
And Macron, the French haven't supplied any weapons to Ukraine compared to Germany and Russia and Britain. So, Macron held out hope for Putin longer than anyone else. I mean, he was negotiating with him. And this, so I wonder if this conversion to the Uber hawk of Europe is genuine or whether it's just sort of smoke screens. You know, we don't know, do we?
I
suggested
absolutely.
In my first monologue, if he's under some kind of blackmailing pressure, you know. So what do you reckon? What has the media been saying about the election in Russia? And apart from
widely condemned, of course. Congratulations messages have been few and far between. Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India has contacted Putin to congratulate him on his victory. India, of course, the second most populous BRICS country, or is it the most populous? We don't really
most
know.
Most populous, yeah.
There are more Indians than there are Chinese now, are there?
Yeah, there are, yeah.
Right.
I tell you what, we'll check it out and we'll have a little bet on it. And I think it's India. Yeah, okay.
So he's congratulated Putin, but of course, Western politicians in general have condemned the election. An organization called Golos, which translates as voice, an independent Russian vote monitoring group, has said that the presidential election Putin has just won in a landslide with nearly 90% of the vote was the most fraudulent and corrupt in the country's history. Never before have we seen a presidential campaign that fell so far short of constitutional standards. Founded in 2000, Golos is the only Russian electoral watchdog independent of the authorities, though it has, of course, been branded a foreign agent by the Russians themselves. And one of its leaders, Grigory Melkonyats, is in prison awaiting trial on what Golos says are politicized charges. I, obviously, from my position, cannot possibly either verify or deny what this group are claiming. And none of us can. This is the problem, really. We don't have any accurate reporting about what's going on in Russia. We don't know how popular Putin really is with the electorate. I get the impression that most Russians are broadly supportive of Putin. That doesn't mean they wouldn't support somebody else. If somebody else was given as much publicity, favorable publicity as Putin, we don't, you know, the simple truth is that we don't really know. But what we do know is that there's an enormous amount of enmity towards him and Russia in general from the West. And we have to ask ourselves, Pelle, would it be any different if somebody else had been elected Russian president, somebody else who basically was like Putin, something of a Russian nationalist. So, you know, it's always the demonization of Putin himself, but really is the West not trying to condemn Russia's stance and position in the world and would like to be able to see it submit to the same wokery and globalism that the rest of the West is forced to endure?
Well, I think so. I think that that's the thing. I think Russians feel that they're the ones targeted, especially compared to what's happened to the Israelis, who are kind of left out of the condemnation. They feel that their cars are confiscated when they go to, they know Russians allowed. The Ukrainian narrative of elves fighting orcs and the Russians are orcs, even though, of course, they're ethnically identical people, you know, has had some, made some headway. And Russians, of course, speak English and they have free access to Twitter and whatnot. And they know these things. And they all, I think that there's this deep hurt among a lot of Russian people that they feel to be culturally European, you know, with Tolstoy and Rimsky-Korsakov and all the rest of it. But they don't feel to be American or Western or whatever, but they feel this part of this European family. And that all this stuff about being close to Asia and the Chinese and for India is just for the birds. I mean, they have to say that because China is their ally. But basically, I think they feel European and they feel that they're not allowed to play with the cool kids a little bit, you know, and they're always demonized. And Putin channels that, you know, he channels that resentment very successfully. And I think maybe Russians feel that if, as you said, they might as well vote for somebody who's actually quite restrained. I mean, there are people far to the right of Putin, like Patrushev and so on, and Shoigu. I think they really want to hammer the West. And that one guy I spoke to says, well, you know, Putin is a softy, basically, or a liberal in the Kremlin, and he's not in charge. I mean, he's and so maybe Russians are choosing, well, we don't want world war, and Putin is restrained, and anyone else would also be hated by the West, so because they really hate us. Just as Trump said, I'm standing here because if they didn't have me to hate, they'd hate you. I mean, that's a very successful slogan that he's using for his deplorable supporters. You know, I mean, they're aiming at me because they're really are aiming at you. And so the American working class can buy into that message because they feel that they're led by elites who despise them. And
I don't think that's inaccurate, Pelle.
No, exactly.
I think that's true of the whole of the Western world, to be honest. You know, record dissatisfaction with politics in Britain. 79% of people in one recent poll said that politicians do not speak for them. 4 out of 5 people. That's very, very dangerous.
Yeah. So I sort of feel, well, okay, so maybe, I mean, we can't run a controlled experiment. Two countries side by side, one where the Russians are basically left alone or made friends with, join NATO or something, and maybe they'd still cheat or whatever, and then the situation now. So it probably is irregular, but everything is context, you know, and we can't just hate on the Russians all the time. You know, I mean, we've got to live with Russia in Europe unless we're going to end up in a smoking ruin, and most Russians are decent people. So stop this demonization of them all the time. I mean, it's deranged, you know. And
in particular, the West is very happy to do business with the Saudis and various Gulf potentates and all the rest of it, all sorts of other undemocratic regimes. And our own democracies are fundamentally flawed as well. So,
Well, fix your own garden, tend your own garden first, I say, you know, because you can almost say, well, maybe we're hitting on Russia because our own problems seem so intractable, you know, so it's easier to demonize someone else and then get the population pushing and looking in one direction rather than dealing with wokery or whatever you want to talk about.
Absolutely. And if democracy is a problem in Russia, then surely the way to further democratize Russia is detente. That's what worked in the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Reagan, for all his faults, reached out to Gorbachev. Yeah. And the old Soviet system collapsed. And, you know, for at least while Yeltsin was in power, Russia was hailed as a new partner for the West and a shining new democracy. No ideological disagreements with them at all. Everything Russian suddenly became trendy and cool. And the old Soviet iconography in particular became a sort of fashion emblem, didn't it? Do you remember?
It did. Yeah.
And now, for some reason in this century, particularly over the last 15 years or so, suddenly they're being demonized again. And it's very difficult to know where that kernel comes from.
Anyway, Basil, we could talk about this further. We've got to end there. We've got our next guest coming on. So, Basil, have a good evening and talk to you tomorrow for the latest news. This is TNT Radio.
TNT's Chris Smith.
I can tell you that Donald Trump is projected to win primaries in the states of Texas, Minnesota, Colorado, Virginia, Maine, Massachusetts, Arkansas, Alabama, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and North Carolina. And in a little bit of a turn up, the northeastern state of Vermont looks to have gone to his final rival, the former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley. Now, Nikki Haley's team has said that she won't be speaking tonight. That has been construed by many of the reporters in that location as she's about to exit the race in the next 24 hours.
Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT.
This is generally the view of people. Oh, we don't know much about Assange. But you should know. Because whether you know it or not, he is fighting for you.
For your courage and leadership and tenacity in journalism and publishing.
Since 2010, Assange has been held in progressively narrower, darker, colder, and crueler spaces.
He has been detained since the 7th of December 2010 in one form or another.
And we are now here after years of imprisonment.
WikiLeaks is a non-state hostile intelligence service.
I think the man is a high-tech terrorist.
A high-tech terrorist.
A traitor, a treasonist.
He has to answer for what he has done.
Assange faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes.
The U.S. government narrative about Julian is a complete fraud. It is a complete fraud from A to Z.
Julian took on the most powerful countries in the world, basically all of them.
We now have confirmed that there were plans to kidnap Julian here in the center of London, or even assassinate him.
No one who instigated that illegal and immoral war has been brought to justice. But the great truth teller sits behind bars.
If wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by truth.
Julian Assange is a hero.
What if everything we thought we knew about somebody was a lie? Would we be willing to go on a new journey of understanding? This is a story of deception, lies, bravery, and a man who risked everything to bring the truth to light.
Mr. Assange shows all the symptoms that are typical for a person that has been exposed to psychological torture over a prolonged period of time.
He looked at me intensely and said, "I hate to say this." He then hesitated, visibly troubled and searching for words. And then he finally said, "Please, save my life."
May future generations have the ability to speak without restraint. May our children and their children know truth and have access to information that leads to justice. Wherever Julian goes, free speech goes with him.
If there is a bird that is about to take flight, stretch her wings and rule the skies, may it be a peace dove and no longer a bald eagle.
If you think Assange is a traitor, he's a rapist, he's a narcissist, he's a hacker, I don't blame you, because you have been deceived. And if you think you've not been deceived, that's normal, because otherwise it wouldn't be deception.
We don't rock. We talk. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelinaroth Taylor Show. Our next guest is David Bell, who's returning to talk about public health and internal physics. He's an internal physician with a PhD in population health. He's worked in international public health for over a quarter century, including positions as a medical officer at the WHO, program head at the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics in Geneva, and director of global health technologies at the Global Food Fund near Seattle. He currently consults in biotech and global health, and is a senior scholar at the Brownstone Institute. Just Google Brownstone Institute and his name, and you'll find his excellent articles on public health, really beautifully written and informative and not technical at all. Anyway, welcome to the show, David. You're going to tell us, you're going to drop the hammer on WHO documents telling we're all going to die of some pandemic, but you think they're all hoaxes, basically. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And the egos of public health officials who are telling us this.
Yeah, I can try. This is work from the University of Leeds, project called Repair that I'm part of. But it's a project. It's just looking at the evidence base behind the push to prioritize pandemics and pandemic responses, which is really the major driver in international public health at the moment, with the World Health Organization, the World Bank. There's statements from the G20 and others. And the project is just looking at the strength of this evidence base, we're leading wherever that goes. So it's interesting. It's, we're being told by these organizations that there is an existential threat from pandemics, that it's a exponentially increasing threat, that we have to prioritize this as an urgency. Otherwise, you hear that there's a three times more likely chance of severe pandemics such as COVID in the next 10 years. And on the basis of this, the world is being asked to prioritize $31 billion for every year for pandemic preparedness, plus another $10.5 billion the World Bank wants for One Health, aspects that aren't covered in that $31 billion. So we're talking about $40 billion plus every year. To put that in context, the World Health Organization's total budget is under $4 billion per year. So we're talking about 10 times the World Health Organization budget on these aspects, just on pandemic preparedness. So people need to understand, most people, but almost everyone on Earth dies of other causes, diabetes, heart disease, infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, malaria in low-income countries, not from pandemics. And the only, what being told, a major pandemic really in the last century was COVID. So people died on average in Western countries at about the age of 80, usually older than the average age of death of COVID. And the overall mortality globally was similar to influenza. So the, you know, we're being oversold, or we were oversold grossly on COVID, and that's done a huge amount of harm in terms of wrecking economies and therefore its impact on health. But we're being told that the, you know, the next pandemic will be worse. We need to have these, the new treaty or agreement at WHO that's going to be voted on at the end of May. We need to reform the international health regulations so that the Director General of WHO can essentially tell countries what to do. Countries will undertake to follow his instructions in the future whenever there's an emergency and he declares the emergency. So we've looked at the evidence base for this, and it's good to give some examples, I think.
To interrupt, David. We'll just go into a quick news break, and we'll talk about those examples, and I'll summarize after a quick news break. This is TNT Radio. We've got a couple of minutes of news now, and then we'll go back to David Bell, who is an expert on COVID and all the lies told about it. This is TNT Radio.
What's happening? Newsflash.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. During a campaign speech in Ohio, former President Donald Trump predicted an economic bloodbath if he is not reelected, particularly focusing on the automotive industry's dealings with China. Representative Barry Loudermilk, chair of a House subcommittee, has indicated that former members of the January 6 investigatory subcommittee could potentially face charges related to the concealment and destruction of the documents.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got David Bell, who's worked for the WHO and is an academic and works for the Foundation of Innovative New Diagnostics in Geneva and director of the Global Health Technologies near Seattle. He currently consults in biotech, and he's talking to us about the ludicrously exaggerated dangers of pandemics, which is a sort of a bureaucratic power grab from the WHO bureaucrats. Most of us die of heart disease and diabetes, or even influenza. And of course, many of you know by now, the average age of the person who died of COVID was about the average age of people dying of other things. So it wasn't an adder to mortality, and rather all these lockdowns had a huge economic cost. And you were saying, what was the flu death rate? It was similar to COVID, wasn't it? So
apart from very old people, so old sick people died significantly from COVID. So if you were over 80 years or 75 years of age, you're quite obese, you had chronic renal disease or diabetes, then it was a real risk. For the rest of the population, it was very low.
So, David, you showed in an article on the Brownstone Institute's website some WHO document which kind of completely misrepresented pandemics, because it had kind of all these diseases arriving, and it seemed to be that they're kind of accelerating the number of risks, but actually you broke them down. Like Zika, for instance, is over basically. So we're not seeing a growth in these pandemics. We're actually seeing that the West has controlled them. Can you just talk us through some of the subterfuge that are carried out by the WHO's manuscript writers?
So those particular examples, there's a couple of documents that the WHO put out, one called Managing Epidemics, one called Future Surveillance, and they came out last year. They both have a graphic which shows, you know, the year 2000, there was no outbreaks, everything was fine. 2020, we have 8 ongoing outbreaks, and we've just resolved a few. And those outbreaks, you know, they're things like yellow fever, cholera, Zika, as you mentioned, influenza, etc. These are obviously things which have been going for a long time and were much worse in the past. You know, yellow fever used to kill, even in the United States, used to kill huge numbers of people. Now it doesn't exist here. So they're trying to give the impression that we have this increasing number of outbreaks when in fact far less people die of these outbreaks than in the past. And we're probably seeing less outbreaks. So that they have a priority disease list. That's where disease X comes from. People would have heard about, you know, waiting for the next disease X. The priority disease list, it includes COVID, which is almost certainly not of natural origin. So it probably shouldn't be on the list. Then we have Lassa fever and Ebola, which are confined to Africa. Lassa fever is an endemic disease. It kills 5,000 people every year in West Africa. Apart from that, there's about six diseases, including Zika, MERS, SARS. None of these diseases, these six, have killed more than 1,000 people each in the entire history of humanity. So these are tiny diseases with, tuberculosis kills 3,500 people every day. None of these are killed 1,000. So they're less than a third of a day of tuberculosis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is what they're selling as priority diseases. And then they bring in disease X because actually, if you look at the numbers, you can see the outbreak disease is a tiny fraction of the health problems that we face. So they need to sell a product. And I think this comes back to where it is not the WHO's, or the WHO is pushing this, and the World Bank, G20, who have similar documents. But the key is that other people are using these organizations, I think. People made hundreds of billions of dollars out of COVID, corporations and people. And they want to do this again. They're putting in place a whole industry where we'll have 100-day mRNA vaccines. And this is coming through public-private partnership called CEPI, where public money is being used to develop this, which will bring private profit to vaccine companies. And they're putting in place a system where we will surveil for these risks. We will find viral variants. We know from this data that they're highly unlikely to harm us, but you can theorize that they might, therefore declare a threat, therefore lock people down, have a 100-day vaccine, which will generate hundreds of billions of dollars more money. Mm. So we're putting in place this situation, which, and we saw through COVID, the, you know, that these people made and these corporations made hundreds of billions of dollars. I think $2 trillion is estimated in profit. Mm. At the same time, the people on the other end became poorer, and health has got worse over this period, and particularly in low-income countries where it's devastating. People have lost up to 2 years of education, increased child labor, increased child marriage, 100 million extra people in severe food deprivation through the COVID response. So this is a massive shift in wealth, and the WHO is being used to promote this going into the future.
And basically, at the same time, so all this COVID business is about increasing the profits of the pharma industry on something that actually a marginal effect on their health. WHO is being using its good name, putting out documents that are almost borderline hoaxes by focusing on diseases, pandemics that actually not pandemics, kill very few people, to give the impression that we're heading into a century of pandemics.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, it's the really poor people who are affected by this because of the disruption and the education and lockdowns. And of course, I guess some people, politicians, will enjoy the fact that they'll control our lives again through lockdowns. And I don't know, they talk about digital currencies or whatever to design where we're going, and we won't threaten them anymore. And at the same time, you know, the big killers, like diabetes and unsexy, if you like, heart disease and tuberculosis. Yeah. Are they being neglected then at the same time as this massive push to fake pandemics is going on?
Well, they are and they will be, and particularly low-income countries. Yeah, I mean, we hear very little about diet. Diet is the driver of heart disease, diabetes, etc. We're almost being told, or we are being told, that obesity is normal. And we shouldn't fat shame people, etc. I mean, it is dietary driven, the problem in the West. In low income countries, it's dietary driven in that there is a lack of food altogether now. But we're also seeing tuberculosis and malaria getting worse. And this is because of a diversion of resources. We know that if you divert resources from malaria, more people will die of malaria because there is a lack of money already for bed nets, anti-malarial medicines, etc. So, and you know, if you reduce gross domestic product, and in Africa, up to 2019, economies were doing very well. They were increasing through 2020, except for a couple of countries like Tanzania, where they did not lock down. GDP reduced, and there is a direct relationship, and the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, and other financial institutions recognize this. There's a direct relationship between GDP in low-income countries and infant mortality. So when we introduce measures that reduce GDP, and these all, you know, they concentrate wealth in the corporations and the individuals, but they reduce wealth in their countries, then we increase the death of children, infant mortality. So we know that in concentrating this wealth, it kills people.
David, we've got to end there. Fantastic to have you. And you summarized in a really good way this massive idiotic story that is relocating profits in the wrong places and locking us down to no benefit and actually massively reducing the wealth of Africa, which is doing quite well, and neglecting serious diseases like tuberculosis and malaria and so on. Thank you very much, David. Love to have you on another time. This is TNT Radio. We're on to our final guest of the day. Thank you.
Thanks.
Oh.
when this the world's TNT Radio. Endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
Meet Norm. He lives with anxiety, but with the help of this latest innovation from Be Normal, he can be normal, just like everyone else. With the swipe of a finger, you can project happiness, confidence, machismo. Why settle for being real when you can be normal? The Normal Maker. New from Be Normal.
This item doesn't really work because there's no such thing as normal. We're all different. What we like, how our brains work. In fact, 1 in 5 of us live with mental illness. Don't filter who you are. Start by talking to someone you trust. And remember, there is no normal.
From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state. Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show. Our final guest is a returnee, an old friend called Ingmar Patrick Linden, PhD in philosophy, who taught philosophy at NYU, University of New York, for many years. He's the author of the bestseller, The Case Against Death, published by the MIT Press, which has been described as foundational for the longevity revolution. He's actively campaigning for aging to be classified as a disease, which could unlock research into the topic. Good to have you back on the show, Patrick. How are you?
Thank you. Great.
It's interesting because the previous guest, David Bell, was just talking about how, you know, all this pandemic panic, which is giving profits to the vaccine companies. I mean, I guess your area of the business would love a $30 billion, which is being misspent on developing vaccines for diseases that might not kill people. What are your thoughts about, what are you trying to do? You've got a team of people that you're trying to focus on classifying aging a disease, because you think that, well, these are the main problems. We're all going to die, but we don't want to. We want to focus on these diseases that really kill us. And can you tell us what you're trying to do and put this on the agenda?
Yeah. So I and some collaborators in Sweden, we are trying to get Sweden to recognize aging as a disease. And so the World Health Organization, they are issuing a international classification of diseases. And in that, currently, aging is not classified as a disease, although they do talk about aging as being an underlying cause of disease. But we want to have the possibility of applying for trials and have medicines recognized as anti-aging medicines. That is, we want to move the kind of anti-aging from the supplements and the cosmetics to the serious science by making this change in classification. And so it really is to spur more research, more development of drugs and more investment, and also to have the field recognized and also to problematize aging.
Yeah, I mean, what we talked about, I think, last time was how we think that billionaires are freezing their heads. You know, I mean, I know your colleagues hate that phrase, but
yeah.
In fact, there's very little research being done on this topic. And we are, I mean, I don't think those vaccines that we've talked about haven't reduced mortality. I mean, they've increased mortality, if anything. And you would be love to get your hands on some of that money. But I was just reading it before our interview. You know, for instance, there's the Japanese researchers have found a new protein that could open up new avenues for treating age-related diseases. Damaged organelles, including neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease. Now, they're cleared away by a protein called hexokinase HKDC1, which helps to protect the body. Now, if you could find some way to boost that, you could actually solve a lot of aging problems. And rather than focus on Parkinson's and Alzheimer's separately and Huntington's, you could go upstream, as it were, and deal with all of them at the same time if you could just unlock research for aging, something called aging. Am I right in saying that?
Exactly. And I think you're referring to the Yamanaka factors, and it's about epigenetic reprogramming. And that is a paradigm, and that is perhaps the most promising paradigm right now for kind of radical life extension. So Yamanaka discovered how you could turn specialized cells into pluripotent cells, that is stem cells, with a protein they called the Yamanaka factors after Yamanaka, and he got the Nobel Prize for it, I think 2013, mm-hmm. around there. Mm-hmm. So what we think is that what if we could turn back the clock of the cell, not to the stem cell state, but to a young, perfectly functioning cell? And that is what we're working on right now. Now, I think you're absolutely correct that it's incredibly underfunded. So about half a percent of the research, the public research budget is spent on it, while 80% of what they spend on healthcare is to try to fix aging-related diseases. So it's absolutely absurd. And if you look at, it's interesting that you started talking about COVID. And when it comes to COVID, people who died from COVID were on average above 80 in Sweden, 83. In America, it was close to 80, just below 80. So it's fair to say that this is also, those deaths were also aging related. So 90% of those who died from COVID were above 65. And it's quite interesting because 90% of all people who die are over 65. So how do you explain that a virus like the COVID kills people who are the same age as cancer kills people? It's about the same average age. It's because there's one underlying, as you say, upstream cause, the mother of the diseases, which is aging. And yet it's so obvious, and yet the conceptual space is always focusing on specific diseases and playing this kind of whack-a-mole game with these. When in fact, you could look at what is the underlying cause of the weakness that makes us much more susceptible to these killer diseases.
But I mean, I felt tempted to talk to the Kennedy guy Corsi about that, because I said, well, why hadn't anyone looked at these X-rays before? Because that to me is totally killing. Why hasn't anyone looked at this? I mean, why has it taken until 2024? For us to discuss aging in the way that you've done, because it makes perfect conceptual sense. Is it something problematic with the way university departments are structured or research? Is there a financial or socio-political cause there that we can deal with? Or psychological, or what is it? People don't want to talk about aging. Scientists can't get money for it. Or what is it?
Well, there are many different forces that are all conspiring against taking this obviously very rational strategy, not to abandon, of course, the kind of science we already do, but to add to it a more kind of fundamental approach. In my book, right, The Case Against Death, I say part of this is that there is taboo surrounding trying to change the parameters that define a human life, right? So there is this kind of a fear of the concept of radical life extension or seeing aging as problematic. People, even scientists, feel that, well, look, those are the parameters we operate within, but we should not try to change them. Of course, I see that as incredibly irrational, and I see it as a kind of leftover from a time when we didn't have science. And you can see it already in the Greeks, right? We're not supposed to object to the conditions of life that the god has have imposed on us, right?
Yeah.
We're not supposed to fly too close to the sun. So it's quite interesting, right, that even very forward-looking people, right, it's like they have a kind of fear here. This is a boundary. And so there is, I think, a taboo around saying, I don't want to die, for example, or I don't want to grow old. That is, grow old in the biological sense that you get sick and weak and so on, right? You want to live. To say that, there's a taboo. You're not supposed to say that. But there's no taboo around saying, I don't want to get sick. So people feel very comfortable.
It's a kind of escapism, isn't it? But it's like, but obviously, aging and death happens to all of us. So it's something that we should grab, because, I mean, why not live if the alternative is eternity dead anyway, I mean, why not just live 200-300 years? What's the problem with that? And you're saying that it's biologically possible in the sense that we've got some animals that do not age or age very slowly, like the hydra, whose risk of dying remains the same how old it is, and very large animals can age very slowly, like giant tortoises and Greenland sharks. Yeah. So are you saying there's no biological reason why we couldn't live like Greenland sharks 500 years? You and your colleagues have talked about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is no given a priori or even biological limit to how long we could live. I mean, it's a question of how long can we keep repairing ourselves. And we look at animals, as you pointed out, there's an immortal jellyfish, there's the hydra. They seem to just keep going, and the only thing that can kill them is something external, but internally they just keep going, right? So there's really no reason for why we couldn't, with science, make ourselves just as biologically immortal, right? Which again doesn't mean that we can't be killed by being run over by a car, right? So death will always be there, but we could definitely extend life. I mean, you mentioned the Greenland shark. Some people believe they can live up to 500 years, right? And I think it's a wasted on a shark, because it's such a boring life compared to a human life.
Well, I mean, are there research programs into the shark and to the hydra? You know, I mean, are these going on at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a research near Barzilai, is one of the researchers based in New York, who is actually studying groups of centenarians, very, very long-lived people, and see what do they have in common, not just how they live, but genetically. Can you identify certain things in your genes that are like long-lived genes? And then, of course, the next step is there a way for us to activate those in everyone, right? Because, I mean, famously, a lot of the centenarians are longtime smokers, for example, but they have certain genetic advantages that protect them from the negative effects of, for example, smoking and other what we see as bad habits, right? So, yeah, there are definitely a lot of research on and also, of course, on long-living animals, but, of course, not enough.
But I mean, this $30 billion a year that the WHO is going to spend on go right into the pockets of the corrupt pharmaceutical industry. I mean, what could you do with $30 billion a year for anti-aging research?
I mean, it's absolutely outrageous how underfunded this is. So you say $30 billion. Well, when the Saudis announced that they would make $1 billion per year available for aging research, right? That was the kind of biggest national investment, right? And that's a 30th as much. It's definitely absurd, especially when you think about how much could be gained by even slowing aging a little bit.
Well, I guess, you know, isn't overpopulation one of the concerns? Is it the Rome Club of Rome or something? And some people have speculated that COVID was designed. I think most people think it was in a lab to kill old people so they wouldn't be useless eaters on our little planet. And that they've got special COVID variants to kill black people or white people or whatever. You know, I don't know, but...
I don't know about that, but that's a terrible argument. And I mean, it's a very old argument. Lucretius made it 100 BC, right? He said, you know, we need to watch out so that we create space for the new generations, right? And at that time, there were only a couple of 100 million people on the planet, right? So it was wrong already then. The fact is this, what drives population growth is not... generally how long people live, but how many children they have, right? So it's fertility and not mortality. So if you look at the longest living countries like Japan, they have such a low fertility that they're actually losing perhaps half the population over this century, despite being one of the longest living country. In fact, generally speaking, the longer a country, the longer the life expectancy is in a country, the slower its population growth grows. And most people live in countries where there is no growth or very, very little growth or negative growth. So it's not a problem, really.
You've been traveling around and giving talks, and I think you wrote earlier that you've been all over the place now. How has your message been received?
Yeah. So, I mean, it has been received very well where I have been speaking, but of course that's a very selective audience of people who are already on board with this. But I have also encountered the typical skepticism, and you voiced the overpopulation worry and such. I mean, my hypothesis is there is an ideology that tells us that to be wise and good, you have to be very skeptical to things like radical life extension. You have to say that you accept aging and you accept dying. That's what people want to hear, right? There's something frightening about saying, look, it would be much better to stay young and alive for an indeterminate
time. I said,
when you can't have it. Yeah.
I mean, people are putting up with it because they felt they had no choice. So they've indoctrinated themselves or been indoctrinated by an education system, by most poetry, by most philosophy, by most films, by most religions, that you know, we have to accept death, and it's extreme. It's the most brainwashed thing that has ever been brainwashed into us. And you're sort of taking a sort of Nietzschean step out of that and saying, "Live, it's not necessary." So in a way, you're the ultimate freedom fighter. You're on a sort of life course to liberate us all from this incredibly depressing and self-defeating psychology that nearly all of us have, you know.
I'm saying it's completely incompatible with the kind of normal liberal sense that we modern people have, that we want to remove arbitrary barriers, right? Big social, but now there's a biological arbitrary barrier here. It's an unfreedom.
There's a guy, I think was it last time we spoke where you said that death will be abolished by 2030? I think that sounds a bit optimistic.
I'm a philosopher, right? So I don't make predictions about the science, right? I can just say that some people are very boosterish about this. I mean, we, you know, Raymond Kurzweil, right, is predicting things like that. I think the first step is this, and this is very important, that it's about now being alive long enough that you can take part of the real cutting-edge science that is probably just around the corner.
Well, I have to say, in a way, you're one of the most optimistic persons I've spoken to, and it must annoy you that not everybody's on board, because you want to liberate them, and you want to make them live longer. I mean, you're not a bringer of death in a way. And yet I'm sure there are some people who push you away, and, you know, It's like, yeah. So do you feel sometimes frustrated? You know, you're the one who's seen the light and you want to help people. Same way, like if we know someone who's an alcoholic and they just won't stop drinking, even though it's good for them, you know, to stop drinking.
I do feel like the boy who sees that the emperor is naked, for sure.
Right.
I see all of these philosophies that are trying to justify why it's good to age and die as being just one giant cope. And I think in the past we could afford the luxury of make believe that we living in a not tragic situation, but now this attitude is creating a passivity that kills. There is a study right now by Nir Barzilai that he's one of the authors of, trying metformin, right?
Patrick, we've got to wind up there, but we'll carry on talking about eternity next time. Thank you very much, Mr. Patrick Minden.